Welcome to the last session of this cycle, The World in Which We Occur, for specially programmed for the Baltic Triennial. This session is called States of Reserve, the Legality of Invisible Regimes. And I don't know if you've all been in the previous afternoons here with us. So it goes that we will call three speakers over the phone and we will listen to their calls together. There is no participation from the audience. I asked for you to turn off your cell phones, if you don't mind, because of feedback and interference. And we will introduce all the speakers, and Jenny will do a small summary of yesterday's session.
So yesterday we delved into what is the notion of grief and how to psychologically adapt to the repercussions of natural disaster today. So that essentially looked at what are both climate deniers and also the effects thereafter of the emotional experience, say, from weathering a natural catastrophe. So we had three different speakers presenting bodies of research also beyond the human to the, say, we can say, if the grievable animal. And so what is a mournable body also for these other kind of entities or and vulnerable beings such as animals. So that was the main axis, and there was a big question is if there can be a sort of concerted political action also for these beings. So today we are gonna reach out and Margaret is gonna introduce a few of the key concepts, and then we'll reach out to our speaker.
Let's say that all the sessions are also archived in the exhibition, in case you do not know, and they will also be online. So you can go to the main hallway in the stairs, the top of the yellow and black stairs, and consult all of the talks of the speakers, dialing a special number. There's a directory, and you can access everything if you want to listen afterwards.
And also one interesting thing is now we have also telephone numbers for direct numbers that you can call from your own cell phone, your landline, into a number to hear the sessions. And we've received those three numbers today. So across the release, we can say during the, as we release the different sessions, there will also be telephone numbers for that you can consult.
So today we're going to be reaching out to Cormac Cullinan, a lawyer and activist from South Africa. Joana Rafael, architect and theorist from London, Porto, Milan. And also Paulo Tavares, who's in transit from Ecuador to New York at this moment. We'll try to catch him in between his flight. And I will read a short summary of the session. The session will inquire and investigate the impact of legal frameworks developed around the phenomena of territorial and resource fetishism, speculating about the interplay between physical and legal systems and their impact over the debate of property and life. How are subjects represented and colonized in this equation? And what is our understanding of them? Can we dare to think at the speed of rocks whose language do we not speak? Inquiring into the influence of climatology and earth sciences on international affairs and the development of transparent policies, we aim to address new models of agency resulting from the dispute of biological domination. I hope it's not too abstract. I'm sure the talks we will have over the phone will be clarifying some of these issues. So let's call Cormac.
Yes. So let's see.
What's the number?
Hello,
Cormac.
Hello, yes.
This is Margarida and Jennifer from the CSC Auditorium in Vilnius. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Hi, Cormac. Jennifer here. I will proceed to introduce you to the audience, and then we'll move forward after that to start addressing the questions that you would like to deliver to the audience today.
Okay,
so Cormac Cullinan is a South African environmental lawyer, author, and activist. His book, Wild Law, A Manifesto for Earth Justice, has helped inspire a global rights of nature movement. He led the drafting of the 2010 Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth and is an executive committee member of the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature and a judge on the International Tribunal for the Rights of Nature. Cullinan has addressed the General Assembly of the United Nations in many international conferences on how to redesign human governance systems to be compatible with the laws of nature. So, Cormac, do you have some questions to address to the audience today?
Yes, thank you very much. Good evening to all of you. One of the questions that preoccupies me is, what is the role of the human being within the Earth community as a whole? As a lawyer, I was trained in traditional systems of law, which have their origins in Europe, and those systems of law are in essence based on and reflect a worldview that came to prominence in Europe during the 16th and 17th century, the so-called Age of Enlightenment. And this perspective sees the world as comprised of objects or resources which are available for human exploitation and use. Prior to this, most cultures in the world, including European cultures, understood the earth as a nourishing great mother or earth mother. They saw themselves as being fed and clothed and nurtured by the earth, and accordingly, the appropriate relationship to earth was one of respect, and also to the other beings, the creatures that they ate, or who were regarded as other members of the great community of life on earth. In the 16th and 17th century, this perspective was replaced by the view that the universe worked like a vast machine, and that if we could take it apart in a reductionist manner and understand how each cog worked, we could operate the machine for our own benefit. So this is a supremely anthropocentric perspective, which sees the value of everything in terms of its value to human beings and places the human at the center of the universe. This perspective was then reflected in our legal systems and our systems of governance. For example, in most legal systems, and certainly in the legal systems which dominate the world in the 21st century, everything that is not a human being or a corporation is defined as a thing, as property. So it is very easy to see that anything is incapable of having rights, in the same way as we might view a table as being incapable of having rights. Now, if one looks at the situation when in periods of history we have defined people as things, we call them slaves, it is very easy to see that if on the one hand you have a slave owner with all the rights, and on the other hand a slave who is property and is incapable of holding rights, there will always be an exploitative relationship between the slave owner on the one hand and the slave on the other. Now, this is precisely the relationship that our legal systems and our economic systems have hardwired between human beings and corporations on the one hand and all other beings and the earth itself on the other. In other words, everything that is not human or a corporation is a property, and the law legitimizes the exploitation of that property in the same way as laws that permitted slavery legitimized the exploitation of people defined as slaves. So it is unsurprising that we have the environmental problems that we have today, because the system is designed to facilitate the exploitation of the wider community in the interests of human beings and corporations. So one of the problems, of course, with this perspective is that it's simply inaccurate. It's just not true. Because what all our sciences, ecology, quantum physics, etc., tell us, as well as the great wisdom traditions of humanity, is that everything is interconnected. We are part of a universe which as Father Thomas Berry said, is a communion of subjects, not a collection of objects. In other words, every aspect of the universe, every being has its own inner spontaneity, its own desire to live and flourish, and each is connected to everything else. So there is no center to this universe, and certainly not the human being. There is also no radical discontinuity between the human being and the rest of the Earth community. In other words, our legal systems presume that there is something fundamentally different between a human being and everything else, which justifies humans having rights and nothing else on Earth having the right to exist or continue its role in the evolutionary system. So we have built our governance systems, we have built the very structures of our society on the basis of a fallacy, and particularly on the basis of the illusion that we are separate from and superior to the entire Earth community. The question that now poses itself to those of us alive at this time is, if we accept, as I think we must, that our system is based on these fallacies, what is the true role of human beings within the Earth community? And how do we move towards systems of governance, economies, legal systems, political systems, social systems, ethical systems, which respect the reality that we are an integral and inseparable part of the community of life? In other words, our destiny is inseparable from the destiny of the wider community. It seems to me that what this requires is that we must begin to find ways in which we align human activities and our goals and purposes with those of the universe itself of which we are part. So how might we do that? Well, it seems to me that whatever field of endeavor that we're in, we need to ask ourselves, in what way do my actions align themselves or run counter to the system of order into which I was born? If one looks, for example, at agriculture, you have people now practicing permaculture and other forms of biodynamic agriculture, where people pay close attention to how the systems, natural systems, work, that it may be appropriate to plant at certain times, it may be appropriate to align the rows of crops so that they're aligned with where the sun rises and sets, etc. These are all endeavors to listen to Earth, to pay close attention to how the system works, and then to align human activities so that we work with the grain of nature rather than against it. Now, it seems to me that as a working hypothesis, even if one cannot prove it very easily, it is like we are more likely to flourish as human beings if we work in a way that is consistent with the flow of nature, with the rules of nature, than if we try and oppose them. And while the forces that flow through the universe and that have brought it into existence are essentially mysterious, what we can deduce from looking at the world around us is that there is an incredible creativity that flows through everything. An energy which I like to call wildness. It is something which is not controllable by us. It is aligned with creativity. It is a source of creativity. And it is a mysterious force which has taken us from the Big Bang and an explosion into the void to the eventual ordering of the universe, the emergence of the galaxies, our solar system, the emergence of life on Earth, and the incredible diversity of life and the complexity of ecosystems that we see around us. So we know that whatever we call it, whether we call it God or the universe or another term, we can observe the reality that there is an incredibly creative force at work. And Father Thomas Berry, who I mentioned earlier, who's a mentor of mine, put it this way. He said, wildness we might consider as the root of the authentic spontaneity of any being. It is that wellspring of creativity when comes the instinctive activities that enable all living beings to obtain their food, to find shelter, to bring forth their young, to sing and dance and fly through the air and swim through the depths of the sea. This is the same inner tendency that evokes the insight of the poet, the skill of the artist, and the power of the shaman. And that was the thinking which led me to write the book Wild Law, because it seemed to me that law could be much more magnificent and appropriate and useful if instead of trying to define everything as property and set out a legal basis for oppressing and exploiting the rest of the world, it set out to foster wildness, to establish the basic rules and conditions by which people would live in order to maximize the flow of creativity, in order to align humans with the primal forces of the universe, in order to encourage diversity rather than stifle it. And this is why one of the central questions that I think it faces us all is, how do we, as primarily urbanized people from the 21st century, reinsert ourselves into the community of life? We have, of course, never really left it. We just have created a system of thought which sees ourselves as separate from Earth. A few days ago, I was with my son and two other fathers and their son in the wilderness area of the Mfolozi Game Reserve in South Africa. This is a place in which is totally unchanged by human activity. No roads are permitted. It is completely wild, and it is essentially the same landscape as our species evolved in many millions of years ago. And when one walks around it, one becomes acutely aware of how inadequate we are. Almost everything can run faster than you, sharper teeth, and is generally much better equipped to survive in that environment. And yet, it is part of our heritage. Every human being comes from a lineage that had its origins in such a landscape and managed to survive. So when one is in a wilderness place like that, one really has to ask oneself, how can I contribute to this community? What good can I offer to this community? But that is simply the same question in a stark form that faces all of us. What are we going to contribute to the community of life as a gift to enhance its perfection that other species cannot give? How is it perhaps, as some have suggested, that we are a force which enables the universe to reflect upon itself? Is our contribution to the perfection of the whole to deepen the consciousness of the universe and to enable the Earth to reflect on itself better? Is it about exploring the limits of will and learning how to limit ourselves for the purposes of the greater good? Is it making music and poetry and dancing in celebration in the great celebratory dance of the universe? These are questions which, it seems to me, are seldom asked in our society, but they are, I think, the ultimate questions of the age. How do we reinvent our concept of ourselves as human beings so that instead of seeing ourselves as masters of the universe, as the pinnacle of creation, as all-powerful, we begin to see ourselves as we truly are, as members of this great community of life, with the responsibility of respecting all the other beings and of working out how we can be a mutually beneficial presence on this earth instead of a destructive force. And of course, we are a most magnificent species. We have been endowed with an incredible range of gifts. We are creative. We have opposable thumbs. We can do amazing things. Unfortunately, in recent centuries, most of our talents have been directed towards the personal accumulation of wealth and the oppression and exploitation of other people and of Earth itself. But imagine the spectacular renaissance that could occur at this time if we decided that the purpose of our government systems should be to encourage that wild spontaneity that has brought about the amazing universe that we see, that seeks to encourage people to contribute to the well-being, the health, well-being, and integrity of the whole planet, that directs our activity to healing the earth and restoring integrity where we have caused harm. This is a huge task, and a task which is sufficiently difficult and challenging to really get our creative juices going. It is what Thomas Berry referred to as the great work, the work of ensuring a just, healthy, beautiful, and sustaining life-giving world for future generations of all species. So, although the environmental issues and challenges of our time are enormous and are often experienced by us as a terrible burden or a fearsome and fearful future, they also represent within them incredible opportunities, because if we are able to embrace the task of redefining for ourselves what it means to be human and what our role on this planet should be, then it opens up incredible possibilities in every field of human endeavor. Because whatever we do, whatever field you're in, if you think, rethink it and think, how would I act or how would I do what I do if I were coming from the perspective that my role is to contribute to the health, integrity, and beauty of the whole community of Earth, of life on Earth and to Earth itself, rather than the very small, meager, and narrow goals which our society say that our activity should be directed towards. So we live in extraordinary times, and these questions open the way to answers which have the potential to not only inspire our lives for the future, but also to rethink who we are, to bring a fulfillment and a connection with the wider community of Earth that will restore our sense of identity and meaning, which is so sorely lacking in the modern world. So I hope that these are questions which go around in my mind about these things and about how we can become, have not only wild law, but wild everything, and align ourselves with the creative forces of the universe, will be useful and to you, and that you will in some way be able to use them as a starting point for developing your own thinking and exploration of these ideas further. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you, Cormac, for your generosity and time.
Thank you very much, Cormac.
Thank you. Have a good day. We'll get in touch with you soon.
Thank you very much, and all my best wishes to everybody there. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And now we're going to reach to Joan Raphael. Thank you. Hello, hello, Joanna.
Hello, Margarita.
Hello, how are you? I'm calling you here from the auditorium of CAC Vilnius. We have an audience of more or less 30 people. And I'm with Jennifer.
Hello, Joanna. How are you?
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, everyone. I'm very thankful to be on this side of the line.
We're going to introduce you briefly, and then we'll give you the time to pose your questions. Yes? So I'm going to read your bio. Joanna Rafael is an architect and theorist. She holds an MRes in research architecture and a PhD in visual culture from Goldsmiths. Her work spans the disciplinary boundaries of architectural practice and theory, the arts, scientific and technological studies, ecological thought, and political philosophy. Her current research investigates crises of the earth and architecture as manifested in acts of reservation and bounded spaces. Currently, she is the editor of Public Domain magazine and a consultant for an architecture and research office and design gallery in Milan. Do you have construction next to you, Joanna? Sorry.
Yes, I have. That's why I'm now a little bit worried, because I asked them to stop the buildings for in this time, but should I go? Well, I think they should stop. Can you still hear me?
Maybe we can hear you. Maybe a room with good windows or... Do you have a dispenser? No.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to kind of close myself, but then I'm afraid of losing the...
Don't worry.
The signal.
We will do our best.
Okay, sorry.
So, I'm just finishing your bio. Joanna is also currently developing her PhD project for publication. This book will examine how reserved realities are enacted through a hybrid repertoire of actions, speculative engineering, and system design that simulate and assimilate patterns of crisis to sustain rather than negate the threat of the end. Thank you, Joanna. Now the role is yours. Do you have time?
Do you have some questions to pose to our audience today?
Thank you for introducing me so nicely, Margarita. First of all, let me share with you that I feel very flattered for the invite to contribute to your live broadcast. Are you listening?
Yes, we're with you.
Yeah?
Yes.
The idea to take on James Libier's and Jeff Cornelis, the World Question Center, and the technological tour of force was an excellent idea.
Thank you.
So, recently I completed my PhD by posing questions about attempts to partition space so as to ensure us against risk and contagion. All these attempts have more or less followed actions aimed at altering the pattern predicted by and predicated on ecologically and social destructive, savagely unjust economies. And the decision to put pretty much indefinitely risk and contagion in reserve formation. From this point of view, to provide you with a simple example, think of nature reserve. How are they maintained to protect and preserve fragile ecosystems and biodiversity on a sanitized, tamed, and overall more human-friendly version of the real and so-called natural environment, against the ravages of human and urban life? Some, like those in Alpes, are so beautifully kept that look in the fake. Ironically, they make us think that the more we try to control nature natural, the more strange and unknowable nature appears. So I ask, what is really at stake in such a partition of space? We know, in the case of nature reserves, that they fall into different categories, depending on the level of protection afforded by local laws and specific designs. Their shape, size, location, and a series of other factors thought to ensure the long-term survival of organisms, also prevent nature from ceasing to exist. The nature reserve belongs for this reason and irrevocably to a cultural category or if you prefer, a play of culture in disguise. Following this idea, how can the decision to set aside an area as a nature reserve help us to retrospectively analyze a way of mystifying nature, or if you prefer, of fetishizing it as a commodity? How does nature reserve show us a way of acting tied to anthropocentric ideas that only enact a culture-nature divide? Man, the conscious cultural being, sets himself against the natural things even when he shames nature free, primarily. In light of such an ambiguity, how did he come to save nature from being treated as a resource by including it in yet another form of resource, and within the task of human domination and salvation? Another way to pose this question is to ask. Are you following me?
Yes.
Yes.
Can you hear well?
More or less. Yeah, I can, a little bit far.
Do you need it louder? Slower?
How did we come to stop the possibilities for a concerted involvement with nature by relying on a fix that postpones rather than treats the very processes involved in the reasons for us to preserve and save nature in nature reserve? These are the core questions my concern for reserve formations address. They refer to divide and isolation of nature as assets, and a treatment similar to that of the patients with tuberculosis, but as well of many goods and poisons. As the prefix G in reserve emphasizes, reserve involves repetition or a withdrawal, and therefore it reflects a curious relationship with the future, but above all, a troubling exclusion-inclusion action, both productive and remedial. And this way, I believe, it also somehow typifies the operation of both sovereignty and anthropological power. I use the concept to name and define a kind of phenomena that has come to permeate and interconstruct the world as we know it, and that continues to be used with excuse to correct the faults of this same world. In question concerning technology, Heidegger defines standing reserve as a principle of order or ordering that turns the world into a sort of petrified relation, neither completely predetermined nor free, but between things and beings waiting in their readiness as raw material or resource for future technical manipulation. There were many reasons for Heidegger to affirm this through the use of reserve as concept, all very modern. We don't have time, neither this is the place to develop on Heidegger's ontology. I just want to say that I took my interest in the reserve as concept from his readings, vis-à-vis the paradoxical nature of forms of reserve formation, such as the nature reserve, used to remedy many crises. Each of the reserve formations was analyzed as its own particular standpoint, yet they all seem to address, directly or by implication, an end. Being this end an end to a means to achieve something, or a condition, an end in itself, a limit, such as death, exhaustion, or extinction. Three of the most serious and widespread concepts or events we are being forced to deal with at a planetary scale. Newspaper headlined daily with news of almost biblical catastrophes, and our collective subconscious, channeled by the arts, literature, and cinema, is plagued by 3 years of impeding the end of nature and the loss of our anthropocentric worldview, if not of human race. We live in an age of ecological panic, masked in the cynicism of ideological denial. This is an uncanny age in which human history has collided with geological time, giving rise to strange and social.
Can you repeat this last sentence, please?
that we live in an uncanny age in which human history can collide with geological time, giving rise to strange and vast phenomena that are impossible to categorize in terms of opposition of culture versus nature, and impossible to tame within such categories. But is this ecological panic a sign that we have an immediate aesthetic relationship with mortality? Or is that has finally arrived the time for us to develop an existential and political strategy and even methodology capable of defeating it? Mm-hmm. Not only as a cause of hardship or distress, but fundamentally as a predicament. So, I've spent 4 years immersed in research, the observation of practices and of discourses concerned with Earth crisis and with solutions to Earth crisis. These are crises that are included, but are not limited to climate-related disasters and their effects that refer to damaged ecosystems, interlands, wastelands, global pandemics, the extinction of many species, and above all, the limit of spaces built to absorb our filthy byproducts. What are crises that have been declared as expressions of power as much as artifacts, yet crises that have never really received the crisis treatment from our leaders as they should, and as so many environmentalists and ecologists have been for so many years kind of claiming. So these are crises that concern the entire planet, atmosphere, soils, water, plants, and animals, and carry the risk of destroying many more forms of life, including the human. Crises that entail an unprecedented emergency, an emergency on a vastly scale, on a vastly greater scale than collapsed banks or destroyed buildings, and that for this reason it became the latest and most comprehensive justification for a political state of emergency, to make enable ecological politics and sense to continue reducing the planet to a machine we can adjust and command to secure security and survival. Anyone familiar with the works of James Lovelock should be familiarized with these ideas. Anyone familiar with the readings of Bruno Latour, Mick Smith, and even now Naomi Klein should be familiarized with the decisionist suppressions these measures entail. One way or another, all these authors and critics have been dedicated to this exposition. The fact is that every day, communal forests around the world are being turned into private tree reserves for their owners to collect carbon credits. And more arguments are pushing nuclear power back to the position of safe and most sustainable energy source, together with a series of new geoengineered solutions sought to double down few of the problems and unlock new reserves of finite resources. To contrast the way our current emergency is being sized requires that we trace connection between political decisions, metaphysical distinctions, and catastrophic collapse. Then we question, how did we arrive at this point? What kind of rhetoric we employ to declare emergency? But as well, what type of means and rhetorics do we employ to claim responsibility over and actually try to stop the processes that took us there? How, as a destabilized climate and Earth system come to be catalysts for a range of different and far less desirable forms of spatial subtraction and sacrificial zones? How are these forcing isolated lands and preserves, many of it also excusing extreme crackdown on civil liberties and interconnectedness of all life, with infrastructures intensely vulnerable to disaster? From domestic sewages to tar sands and Fukushima, Chernobyl continues to provide with a clear example. in very short order, the sacrifice zone created to cordon off and isolate the Chernobyl disaster has gotten a great deal larger, swallowing ever more territory and putting many persons who thought to be at safe at risk. But as long as the zone is kept safely out of view and enclosed, the rest of the world feels normal. Ecology, however, means inevitably responsibility, forces intimacy, and above all, coexistence. It means that there can be no away, as Timothy Morton so well exposes. Everything stands awkwardly close. The dimensions that is articulated by the envelope and umbrella of reserve formations expose a fundamental gap between actual material reality and our distorted perception of the planet. The limits between inside, controlled environment, and outside, framed spectacle, seem to remain at the level of the symbolic. This is what makes me pose questions about attempts to partition space as last resource, to ensure us against risk and contagion. After all, and to close my set of questions, could we not think to activate all our doubts and reservations toward the planet in a way other than by partitions? Here it is.
Thank you, Joanna.
Thank you very much, Joanna.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll get back to you this week. Hope to see you soon.
Sorry for these noisy neighbors.
I think we survived, some of us.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, Paul Tavares.
Yes.
Hope he already left his plane.
This is our last speaker today. We'll go ahead and proceed to call Paulo Tavares. He's en route to New York, is that correct?
He's now landing Quito. In Miami. This message was recorded by Paul Tavares after we were unable to reach him at the time of this session, during which we were stranded at the border of USA. I will introduce him and then pass to the recording. Paul Tavares is an architect and urbanist, graduated in Brazil and teaches at Goldsmiths, where he also completing a PhD. His work is chiefly concerned with spatial politics, ecology and media. Recent projects deal with the relations between environmental violence and law, in the case of internal armed conflict in Guatemala and the colonization of the Amazon during the military dictatorship in Brazil. He also teaches in the Faculdade de Arquitetura, Diseño e Artes at Pontificia Universidade Católica de Ecuador.
Until very recently, the idea of the earth, the idea of nature, from a Western, modern, / colonial point of view, was practically synonymous to the idea of the reserve. Right? From this perspective, a very particular perspective, the earth and nature were considered as a reserve that was limitless, that was infinite, that was endless, and in which humanity could explore, exploit, it could use, it could mine, could drill, could consume at its will. Right? The earth was, the nature was considered this reserve, this object of appropriation of humankind, which would be the propelling engine, the driver of growth, of economic growth, of material accumulation, of quote-unquote development, of progress, and ultimately the driver of civilization itself. Now this idea, this image of the nature of the earth as the realm of abundance, as a reserve of abundance, is not only at the core of modernization / colonization, but also of the most important political ideologies generated along the last century, right? And occupies the entire political spectrum, both at the communist and the capitalist side. Capitalism, for example, would say that at a certain point in the future, humanity, the entire planet, would achieve a certain level of consumption and material use as Western societies. And this is the sort of utopian view that capitalism sells or propagates, that we would achieve, everyone would be somehow developed to the same extent as Western Europe and North America. And communism, although diverging or propagating different means and arrangements in the relations and means of production, also share with capitalism the same idea that Earth would be the provider of the material resource that would generate this more equalitarian society, and that based on the limitless and endless extraction of the Earth as a reserve, this society, this sort of utopian and more equalitarian society, would be built. So they share the same concept of the Earth as an object of appropriation, and the Earth as a sort of lifeless reserve of material that could be exploited by human societies, only the means and relations of productions that would be somehow different in the social order. Now, as we know, this ideology cultivated, generated by modern / colonialism, and which somehow is still alive, has been fractured by facts, by numbers, by raw statistics, by things that we see every day in the news. Now let me give you some examples, some numbers of this. In 1960, humanity itself, of course, let's consider, you know, that humanity is a very problematic concept, because patterns of consumption are unevenly distributed across the globe and serve as a means of domination. But let's forget this for a while and come back to the raw numbers. So in 1960, humanity would need at least 60% of the Earth to fulfill its consumption demands. 15 years later, in 1965, humanity would need more than 90% of the Earth to fulfill its consumption needs. 5 years later, in 1980, we needed at least one planet, 100% of the Earth as a reserve to fulfill our consumption needs in the future, right? To sustain humanity alive in the future. And today we need at least 1.5 Earth as a reserve to sustain humanity in the future. That is to say, the state of the reserve, to use the term that titles this intervention, the state of the Earth as a reserve, of nature as a reserve, is depletion, exhaustion, consumption. And in as much as the idea of the reserve, to a large extent, refers to a certain future, right? Something that you have as a reserve is directly related to an idea of future, something that you reserve now, that you preserve now, because you would need this in the future. And insofar as the reserve, there is this insofar as the idea of the reserve contains this idea of the future, and in as much as there is no Earth as a reserve anymore, as it has been depleted, one could say that logically or by consequence there is no future, or at least there is no future for this type of thinking, or this type of thought, of this type of engagement with the Earth, the planet, nature as merely and simply as a reserve, as a pool of natural materials, of resources that could be appropriated and used by human societies. Now, this condition of the Earth as a depleted reserve, of nature as a depleted reserve, urges us to engage in a rapid and profound transformation in our economic and industrial models. It points to the pressing necessity of divesting from fossil fuels, for example, or engaging with renewable and sustainable forms of energy production, or preserving, restoring crucial ecosystems like the oceans, coral reefs, and tropical forests. Just another example using statistics. If we want to maintain the temperature of the planet below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, which is the target set by the United Nations and the so-called international community, this would require to leave underground at least a third of the current oil reserves, more than half of the gas, natural gas reserves, and more than 8% of coal reserves. Now, in total, if we add the charted and untapped deposits, that is to say, the reserves that we know already and the reserves that potentially exist but have not been mapped, it's estimated the global resource base counts with 10 times more fossil fuels that can be extracted in the near future. This implies that all those reserves are considered unburnable, that is to say, that oil must be left on the ground, that this carbon must be locked on the ground, that is to say, that they should remain as reserve, right? In as much as, let me rephrase it, therefore the reserve has become a sort of political ground to a large extent. However, contrary to any possible logical reasoning in face of this existential threat posed by climate change to humanity itself, what we have been witnessing in the last decades, and especially in the past 15 years, is precisely the opposite move in exponential escalation. Another is statistics. So since the early 90s, when the United Nations set up the Convention on Climate Change, to try to halt the emissions of greenhouse gases. In fact, worldwide CO2 emissions have increased by 50% at least. That is to say, we are accelerating the emissions of greenhouse gases rather than containing them. This means that we are going as climate change gets pace, as we enter into the Anthropocene, we are also entering into a different geopolitical geological scenario. As the most accessible and easiest to extract deposits are exhausted, cheap oil, cheap gas, cheap minerals, they will be no longer abundantly available anymore. And there are huge investments being directed to advance the technological capacity to explore all these formerly unreachable reserves and the so-called unconventional fuels, such as, for example, shale gas and heavy crudes, which are much harder to extract, and they demand much more energy and water for processing, and are much more environmentally harmful. So mining and drilling are being pushed deeper underground, where large-scale and high-risk extraction activities are expanding to the remotest and most biologically sensitive regions on the Earth. Now, we can see this through several examples. Consider, for example, Western Amazonia. All this entire area of Eastern Amazonia, perhaps the most important biological refugee on Earth, has been allocated for oil drilling. Consider, for example, the Arctic, which is also crucial for climate change. It's also a new frontier of oil exploitation. Rather than acting as a deterrent, the global environmental crisis is driving an aggressive resource rush, and the magnitude of this resource rush is arguably unparalleled. This demonstrates that what I call the post-climate change Anthropocene geopolitical condition will be dominated by even more ferocious competition between states and corporations alike to secure access to strategic reserves of fossil fuels, industrial minerals, arable land, and fresh water. Although natural resources are rapidly shrinking, the Anthropocene plus climate change state of the Earth system will be characterized not as much by a passage from a past of plenty to a present of scarcity, as we suppose, but by what security scholar Marshall Clare describes as a transition from an era of easy supply sources to an era of tough reserves. Now this shift, this sort of historical transition from an era of easy supply sources to an era of tough reserves, which is also a transition from the Holocene to the Anthropocene, which is also a transition from a climatic stable planet for a post-climate changed planet, is already undergoing, and it's already present, it's already identifiable. For example, there has been a massive movement of neo-colonial land grabs in sub-Saharan Africa in the last 10 years or so. As I mentioned before, Amazonia has been all allocated, entire Western Amazonia has been allocated for oil drilling and gas drilling. As I also mentioned before, consider for example the Arctic, which is the ultimate frontier of petroleum extraction expansion, as well as the deep oceans, which are also this new frontier of capitalism extractivism. And at the same time as we are seeing this movement, this new global resource rush, we're also seeing that the planet is being ravaged by ever more frequent extreme climate events, such as the Hurricane Katrina in the United States, severe droughts all across South America, Russia, China, and Middle East. California is being raged by wildfires at an unprecedented level and suffering one of the worst droughts in its history. And, or for example, consider São Paulo, the largest Latin American metropolis, which is facing one of the worst water shortages in its history, and probably this will only be aggravated in the future to the extent that we are going to face the massive displacement of the poor population of cities such as São Paulo because of lack of water supplies. In parallel to this resource rush, and at the same time, this advancement of very high risk extraction activities, what we are going to witness, therefore, is environmental accidents on a much larger scale. And a proof of that is, of course, the BP oil spill in Gulf of Mexico in 2008, which is a type of deep water drilling which is expanding and for which we don't have the adequate safety measures. So the continuation of the type of thought, the type of thinking, the type of economics based on the idea of the Earth as a pool, as a reserve of natural resource that can be exploited at will, is a much more turbulent and volatile globe. And the interactions and collusions between all this multivalent force, both environmental and political, will of course intensify disputes over land and natural resources, and therefore they will lead to growing social upheaval, they will grow political disputes, and they will lead to growing conflicts. as much as so, and chiefly because all those remote areas where still resources, natural resources, these reserves of natural resources are located, such as Amazonia, Arctic, and for example, Central Africa, Southeast Asia, they are, of course, not depopulated zones, but they are zones populated by local populations, which are being continuously colonized and expropriated of their lands. So this is the sort of geopolitical, geological landscape within which we are dwelling right now. In this new geopolitical, geophysical condition, I think indeed a crucial question, as this phone, this conversation suggests, is what do we think, how to conceive, deconstruct, or rethink the idea of what is a reserve, in as much as the idea of reserve is very much connected to the idea of the future, and to a large extent, our own future, but not only our own, but ultimately the future of life itself on this planet. So that's the sort of question that I would pose after this long, although necessary, introduction. How can we reconceive the idea of reserve, which I believe should be rejected, but at the same time reappropriated and reframe as a side of different types of politics, a different types of ethics, and a different types of thought. Let me reply my own question to you by telling a story, which is very much related to my own work and my own experience where I live in Ecuador, South America. Ecuador, as some of you may know, some may not, consider by constitutional law nature as a subject of rights, meaning nature is similar to humans, bearing a rights holder entity. That is to say, nature has fundamental rights as similar to humans have fundamental human rights. And indigenous peoples and environmental activists, land defenders, natural defenders are using this law, the rights of nature, precisely to contest this idea of nature simply as a reserve, a pool of natural materials, which is fundamentally a colonial idea. And they're doing this in very pragmatical terms. As for example, they're trying to implode this law to maintain a huge pool, a huge reserve of oil on the ground in a very particular area in the Ecuadorian Amazonia. So there is this very pristine biological diverse area in Amazonia, which also holds huge quantities of oil, and they're using the rights of nature to say, in as much as we consider nature as a holder of rights, we cannot extract this oil because that would inflict some form of violence to nature that would violate the rights of nature to exist, or the rights of the forest to survive in this area. Now, by considering this pool of oil underground as a reserve that should be preserved as a reserve, in as much as Amazonia should be preserved as a biological reserve, this type of thought is at the same time reappropriating, reconfiguring the notion of reserve, and at the same time deconstructing the Western colonial notion of reserve, which thus far was very much based on preserving natural parks or place of biodiversity that were connected to the boundaries of the nation state to a large extent, or just plots of land where nature should be preserved, whereas everything outside would be exploited or used by society. And this had, to a large extent, effective but limited effects, if we think about it, because its radius of action was limited to a certain territory. When you consider the underground, the geological, as a potential sort of reserve, and you say, well, we need to leave oil underground, you're acting as much locally as well as on the very geophysical structure of the Earth system, insofar as you are holding carbon on the ground and therefore halting climate change, halting global warming, so you are acting to a large extent geophysically and, in the current context, geopolitically. And you are acting on the future. And this notion of this underground reserve is not seen as merely a pool of natural resource that can be exploited, points to a type of political thinking that is not limited or not centered in humankind itself, but acted geologically, geopolitically, and ultimately, we could say, cosmopolitically. And this is the type of thinking that perhaps the very notion of reserve, in its intersections with a different conception of nature, with a different conception of the earth, is necessary in the current political situation.